they have certain requirements under the law that have to be met, and if they're not meeting those requirements, they certainly can face fines from us, and they can face legal action from homeowners.
Planet Money. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Alex Bloomberg. Today is Tuesday, October 19th, and that was Robert Gibbs talking about the foreclosure mess you heard at the top. Today on the podcast, is a dead-end job really a dead end?
But speaking of dead-end jobs, we have with us in the Planet Money Indicator, our own J. Julius Jacobo Goldstein.
Hey, Adam, I'm going places. This is just the beginning.
All right.
All right. What do you got for us today?
Today, for you, I have $10.4 billion. Bank of America said that it's taking a $10.4 billion charge on its balance sheet. It's because of these new federal rules that are coming next year and that are likely to hurt B of A's debit card business.
Now, this is a huge number. It was enough to turn what would have been a $3 billion profit for B of A into a $7 billion loss. That's a big turnaround. But this is one of those weird kinds of losses that isn't really a loss. So a charge on its balance sheet. That's simply an accounting term that companies haul out when they report their quarterly earnings. And what it means is something is happening beyond just the ordinary costs and revenues in that business.
And that something in this case is these new rules for debit cards. The rules will be out next year. Under the current rules, when you buy something at the store with a debit card, the store has to pay your bank a fee of about 1.5%. So if you spend $100, the bank gets $1.50, right? But the Dodd-Frank bill, the big finance bill passed earlier this year, says the Fed needs to make new rules about these fees. It's not exactly clear yet what those rules are, but clearly by taking this huge charge, B of A is basically saying these new rules are going to mean lower fees for us.
But this doesn't mean we'll pay more or less when we use a debit card. Is that right?
That's true at the store. You know, I think the place where people might actually see it is in their checking accounts at the banks, because banks have basically been making a lot of money from retail customers on fees like this and overdraft fees. And now that those fees are getting squeezed, I think what we're likely to see is a lot less free checking. So we'll probably pay more for checking, pay less in these kind of hidden fees.
Well, I definitely wanted some way to help defray Bank of America's painful loss in this case, so I'm glad to hear.
Right. Don't worry. They'll get their $10 billion back, you know, $5 at a time.
Thank you very much, J. Julius Goldstein.
Thanks, guys.
So on with the rest of the show. I actually can't wait for the rest of this podcast because you, Alex, and Caitlin have been talking for weeks about this book you've been reading and how it's like the most interesting book you've read in a really long time. And today we are doing what we here at Planet Money call a deep read, where we just have one juicy, awesome conversation with someone whose ideas we really find interesting. And so just explain, who is this author and what's the book?
So today we're talking with Catherine Newman, and she is a sociologist, and she's written a book called Chutes and Ladders, Navigating the Low-Wage Labor Market. And this book is really fascinating because it doesn't read like an academic book. It reads almost like a novel. It's full of like these powerful stories about starting at a low-wage job and trying to work your way up. And so what Catherine Newman did, she interviewed 200 people working for minimum wage in an inner-city fast food restaurant, which she refers to as Burger Barn. She also interviewed another 100 who were trying to get jobs and didn't get them. And it's interesting because instead of just giving you a snapshot of these people at just one time and place, Catherine Newman followed them for 8 years. She would check back in with them periodically to see where they went from that minimum wage job and whether they moved on, whether they kept working, whether they got a better job. She just followed them.
And I love this idea. I mean, we as reporters are constantly interviewing someone at some precise moment in their lives, and I'm so envious of the ability to follow them. So how did they do?
Well, it's a complicated picture, as you might imagine. But Newman breaks the people that she covered, she breaks them into three groups, which she calls high flyers, and that's people who basically escape poverty altogether. They go on to much higher paying jobs. Then there's the up but not out group. They're moving up the wage ladder, they're ahead of inflation, but they haven't escaped poverty. And then there's a group that she calls bumping along the bottom. And they are in the same or worse position at the end of the 8 years than they were in the beginning when she first interviewed them. So Newman followed about 300 people, and she says that of that group, a little over 20% made it into the high flyer category. And then the rest were divided pretty evenly between bumping along the bottom and up but not out. So we started our conversation talking about the high flyers, two people in particular who she calls Jamal and Kaisha. She started off talking about Jamal.
When I first met him, he was 22 years old, an African-American kid living in a rat-infested tenement, one of the most dilapidated places I've ever been in, with the wind blowing through the windows and rats on the floor and a shared kitchen. This is where very poor people live.
Shared the kitchen with another family?
Oh, with six other families and a bathroom down the hall. These are just sort of buildings that have been broken up and made into small little studios, if you will, but with very substandard facilities. And he was not well educated. He dropped out of high school. When Jamal was 13, his mother, who was a very serious heroin addict, I mean a scary character, started sending him out to work to survive. And she took his money and she blew it in drugs. So when I met him at 22, he was already an eight-year veteran of the labor market, but not a very successful one because he didn't have much education. So 4 years later, when I did the first follow-up for this book, I couldn't find Jamal. I searched for him everywhere. I couldn't find him. Or more to the point, I actually found someone that I just didn't believe could be him because this someone was so far away. I thought, this is impossible. So I didn't pursue it. At the eight-year point, when I was doing the final follow-up, this someone comes up again, and I thought, you know, what if that is Jamal? I should really try and find him. So I sent one of my research assistants out to the West Coast, and lo and behold, there he was. 8 years later, Jamal is now 30 years old. He's married. He has three kids. He has a home. He has a steady job. It's a factory job, but he's earning five or six times an hour what he was earning when I met him. He has a motorcycle, which he's very proud of. He lives in a comfortable rural community, actually. He worked for a wood laminating factory. So he found the sweet spot, which was a job that requires skill and hence is reasonably well paid but doesn't require a lot of education. Relative to where I found him, I never would have believed that this would have been Jamal's fate. Never. I mean, I don't even... How did he even get to the West Coast?
And this is the West Coast. This is like the Pacific
Northwest,
right? Sort of
way northern
California.
So this is like the Redwood country where wood laminating is done. So he was so far away from his origins in many ways. He had a steady job. He was earning a decent living. He had a roof he could put over his family. They had a computer. They had food on the table. They had all the things that the rest of us take for granted but were manifestly not part of Jamal's life when he was 22. And if you could have told me at 22 that that was where he was going to end up, I would have thought you were mad, absolutely mad. So he was one of those people who managed to find himself in a unionized job that demanded some skill but not a lot of education, and where workers were treated fairly well because what they produced was important. And if the factory gums up and stops working, well, the company's losing money. Mm-hmm. So that was one very important route to upward mobility, finding a job that was a unionized job in industry. The second person I would like to tell you about had a different path in some ways, but an equally interesting story. Kaisha, who when I met her was 21 years old. She had worked for 6 years by that time for Burger Barn and was earning about 50 cents an hour more than when she had started. So basically, she saw no improvement whatsoever in her wages. Mm-hmm. She was working double shift all during the day, all during the night. Her mother, who had been on welfare for a very long time, where Kaisha had never been on welfare, was taking care of her child. She had had a child out of wedlock when she was 19 years old. So her mother was the informal childcare labor force that is missing from the scene in many ways, and that made it possible for Kaisha to stay in the labor force. But the conflict between these two women was building. Who's really in charge here? Who is really the mother or authority figure over this boy? A lot of tension in this household. And we sometimes romanticize these three-generation households. They do provide a working labor force that makes it possible for low-wage workers to stay on the job, but there's a lot of tension in those households.
Right.
And Kaisha, I had Kaisha, Jamal, and everyone that I knew very well for this study kept diaries for me, which I still have. And these diaries are among the most valuable possession I own as a social scientist because these were their daily accounts of their lives. And when I went back to Kaisha's diary, you know, from 8 years before, it's filled with agony and how am I ever going to get out of here? And I'm going to pack this box full of my stuff so that if I find a place to live, I can just move out right away. And, you know, I met this guy and he looks like a really good bet. And I wish I could have a relationship with him and get married because then I could move out of here. She was desperate to get out of there. Uh-huh. And it wasn't going anywhere. And at the four-year follow-up, nowhere. She was still stuck with her mother. But 8 years out from the beginning, Kaisha is a miracle. She's a civil service worker. You know, this is the holy grail for poor people in New York City to find a city job because it has benefits, because it's unionized, because you can make a decent living. She was working as a maintenance worker in the big high-rise housing projects that belong to the city of New York. She was doing extremely well. She was earning, I think, something like $30,000 a year. Mm-hmm. Also, completely incomprehensible from where she started out. She had been able to move into her own apartment with her son, who by that time was 10 years old. She had a real future ahead of her, and she was studying for civil service exams that would allow her to move up the structure of the labor force inside those buildings. She was on cloud nine compared to where I found her.
And so she also counts as a high flyer.
She counts as a
high
flyer.
And that also gives you some sort of sense, like a $30,000 a year job with benefits is considered high flying when you're starting at minimum wage without benefits at a fast food restaurant.
That's right. So
Kaisha and Jamal are examples of high flyers.
Right.
There's something like 22%, I think, of the sample fit into that category.
That's
people
right.
who had fully sort of gone and were making much better wages were part of a different class, essentially, than the one they'd started in. There's another big subsection. What do you call those?
Up but not out are the people who really have been doing better. They have better jobs. They don't earn a lot more money, but they moved from service sector jobs into white-collar, sort of low-level white-collar service jobs. They work now in shops, right? They're shop assistants, for example. They're not doing dirty jobs. They're doing jobs that they can where they can hold their heads up a little bit more, but they're really only barely ahead of where they started economically. They might have been earning a couple dollars more than they were per hour than they were at the time that I found them. And so they're really barely keeping up. If they are able to find partners, their households may look a lot better, but their own individual wages are really not much better.
So can you just give me an example of somebody who's in that category, the up but not out category?
Right. So LaToya was working in the same Burger Barn restaurant as Kaisha, and she started off on the shop floor earning minimum wage. She graduated to the first line of management, which paid her about 50 cents an hour more. But eventually, because this was a period of great prosperity and you had new restaurants opening, the owner of the restaurant where she worked acquired a new franchise and then began to look for managerial labor for that new franchise. And she became the manager of a new restaurant, the same firm.
Mm-hmm.
Now she's moved
barn.
The new Burger Barn in a few blocks away because they're not that far apart. But her maximum earnings were about $25,000 a year, and she had a family of five. So that puts her, you know, slightly above the poverty line at the time, but not very far above the poverty line. What really made a long-term difference in LaToya's life was eventually she got married, and that meant there was more than one income in the household. But during the bulk of the time I was studying her life, she was a single mother. And trying to support a large number of children on that wage. She just wasn't far enough up the ladder and at high enough an income level to be truly secure. She didn't have health insurance. There are many aspects of these kinds of jobs that just don't favor a worker's long-term stability, like the lack of health insurance, no sick pay. You know, you're really on your own if your kid gets sick. And if you have four kids, somebody's going to get sick. But LaToya was a success story of sorts. She was able to pull herself up with very low literacy. And in this, even in this firm, you have to be able to read. You have to be able to pass simple exams. But those exams are testing your capacity to read and process information. And so she had to work very hard at doing that.
So she was one of the rare people who stuck with her job at Burger Barn, mm-hmm. And had taken what meager advancement opportunities there were and sort of parlayed them. And so at the height, she's working as an assistant manager at a fast food restaurant. But that actually does give her good job experience, even though she's a high school dropout.
That's right.
And she does manage to make a jump into a sort of a higher wage fast food dish type of situation, Starbucks.
Right.
Where there is actually more earning potential. And she has a really interesting experience there. Could you just talk about that for a second?
So if you look at your average Starbucks, they employ people behind the counter who are more middle class in their demeanor. And LaToya didn't feel that she quite fit there. And she didn't feel as though the other workers at Starbucks respected her experience. She had a lot of experience running establishments by that time. I mean, she had been not just an assistant manager. She had been a real manager in Burger Barn. But she had all kinds of suggestions about how they could do the work better because Burger Barn is a rapid service industry. A customer has to come in, they have to be served within, 20 seconds or the profit model doesn't work. And she found that in her Starbucks where she was working, the customers were backing up, right? The long lines of customers out the door and getting frustrated because they weren't being served fast enough. And she had some ideas about how to speed the process up, still consistent with Starbucks process. And she couldn't get anybody to listen to her.
She had a lot of restaurant management experience.
It didn't matter. She came from a stigmatized industry, black woman, not great diction. And that was enough for people to discount, as she told it anyway, to discount her experience.
Right.
So she went back to the place where she was respected and where she could have a good career, although it didn't pay very well.
And so she quit the job at Starbucks.
She did. She didn't last very long there at all. She was looking for more respect. And a little bit more money, but mostly more respect.
But didn't she make less money at that place?
Yes.
Yeah.
But she went back to the place where people...
So in the contest between money and respect, she chose respect over more money. And the other thing that I found really interesting about LaToya from the book is she had kids with this guy who you called Jason. Mm-hmm. And Jason was pretty... was a pretty hot character. He was like he had a pretty good job.
He
was earning
a lot of
money.
Skilled worker.
Yeah. He's laid...
He laid floors, uh-huh. Wood floors.
And he had his own house.
He was earning good money.
And she was pretty smitten with him. And
totally smitten. Desperately wanted to marry him. And eventually he married her. But this is a sad aspect of life at the bottom of the labor market. So many women whose households would be rescued by multiple incomes often find that the only way they can bring multiple incomes in the house is for their children to go to work because they can't find partners who will stick with them. And if you can marry, or even if you're not married but just have two adult incomes in the house, it makes a huge difference, huge. And it is often not easy to do. Mm-hmm. And it's just a sad aspect there, the intersection of family formation and the low-wage labor market, that you've got so many women who are responsible for the care of their children and the men are not as easy to corral into those responsibilities. And a low-wage worker with a single salary is a poor person, almost inevitably.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why LaToya's story is a happy ending, because she did marry and it did make a difference, not just in her sense of happiness, but in the economic stability of her household.
All right. So and then the third group is the bumping along the bottom group. This is sort of like intermittent unemployment, no real wage growth.
Right.
Long spells out of the labor force. So one of the things that I want to try to figure out is, What story is this telling us about worker mobility over the long run? Like, there's this sense that you have when you think about, Central Harlem and fast food, that both of those have sort of the notion of dead end attached to them, right? And so clearly it's not a huge springboard for every single person, but on the other hand, it was more of a springboard than you were imagining. What is the takeaway there?
I think there's a very clear takeaway, which is that a dead end becomes a stepping stone in a much better economy, and stepping stones become dead ends when the economy tanks. When labor markets tighten radically, employers have to look beyond the stigma that LaToya experienced. And they have to hire people. They have to hire young black men with no education if the economy gets tight enough, and they do. So we have data that shows in the early 1980s in Massachusetts, the so-called Massachusetts miracle, or in the late 1990s here in New York and in other parts of the country where you got really tight labor markets, I mean way below so-called frictional unemployment levels, you start to see all kinds of people who were previously at the very back of the queue and widely regarded as unemployable flooding back into the labor market and getting jobs. And that's not because they changed overnight. It's not because their work ethic somehow changed overnight or even their skills. It's because the economy provided more opportunity and they jumped for it. To me, this is the most optimistic and yet cautionary tale. It's optimistic because it says it's not the people who are broken. It is the opportunity structure that's at issue here, because even people at the very, very bottom, who, and that's who I was studying for those 8 years, will make it up that ladder if there's a tight enough labor market and their skills can connect with opportunities that are opening. But by, you know, by the same token, when the economy craters, there is nowhere for these people to go, nowhere. And that's where I began in the early 1990s in Harlem, where you had grown-ups trying to raise families on a minimum wage job because the economy was a disaster for them.
So let's say that, as many economists are predicting, that we're not going to have rapid growth for a while, and you were to do the study starting now, are you saying that in the next 8 years, if we don't have a late 90s boom again, you wouldn't find the same thing? You wouldn't find a third of those fast food employees up and out?
I doubt it. You would find people who were trying, but the stories of high flyers would not be as common as I found them to be, because that requires the best of all possible economies to lift people out of poverty into something much better. Really does require growth. So, no, I'm very worried about their children. I'm worried about what's going to happen to the children of these people, because they are coming into an economy that is very unfavorable. And if you start there and it takes a long, long time for the economy to pick up, you could be scarred by a labor market like that. We know this from the studies of the Great Depression. In a persistently bad economy, you can hit a point where it's almost irretrievable. And even when the economy recovers, you're too damaged.
So on Planet Money, this is going to be a big theme for us for the next year or so, is who is screwed and who isn't screwed in the new economy, both in the short run because of the recession, but maybe more importantly in the long term because of structural shifts in our economy that are clearly going to hurt some and benefit others. And Catherine Newman's work will be a very helpful jumping off place.
Before we go, we want to say a quick thanks to Russ Roberts. It was on his wonderful podcast, Econ Talk, that we first heard Catherine Newman interviewed and wanted to talk to ourselves.
Yeah, hat tip, Russ. Also, this just in, we have the results of a poll we've had on our blog at npr.org/money, which is off of David's podcast the other week, about whether you would rather make $70,000 a year in 1900 when you would have been extremely rich, but you wouldn't have had any of the modern devices and medical care, etc., that we have today, or would you rather make $70,000 today when you'd be middle class? Well, the economist who told us about this said that generally about a third of his students, when he proposes this, say they'd rather be very, very rich in 1900. And two-thirds say, no, I'll take the antibiotics, please. I want to be middle class in 2010. And remarkably, our poll, we had 3,565 people enter the poll, and 30.88% said, I would rather be really rich in 1900. And 69.12% said, I want the antibiotics. I want to be middle class in 2010.
Wow. That's a nice big data set there.
Yeah, 3,500. I mean, it's a voluntary poll, but I think this effectively proves 2010 kicks 1900's butt.
a majority of people believe.
Yes.
All right. Well, please tell us what you thought of today's podcast on our Facebook page, facebook.com/planetmoney.
Or on our blog, npr.org/money. Also, we do really read all your emails, planetmoney@npr.org. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Alex Bloomberg. Thank you for listening.
And the sun was on the rise. I never felt so wicked. as when I willed our love to die, and I was your soul.